A quick note here before we get started. In this episode, I'll be discussing some topics, including sex work, that might not be appropriate for younger listeners. How ancient Greeks and Romans understood sex and gender doesn't mesh well with our modern sense of morality. Some of what we discuss in this episode might be shocking, disturbing, or triggering. The sound of the burbling crowd intruded on Publius's thoughts. He preferred quiet. He needed it to write. But in Rome, quiet was hard to come by. Hundreds of thousands of people rattled up and down its winding streets, crowded together in the narrow tabernae where they ate and drank, and slept body to body in rickety apartment buildings that leaned precariously over the packed roadways. Coughing, yelling, laughing, living. That was what Rome was to Publius. That crowd paid his wages. Well, the crowd and his wealthy patrons paid his wages, but the crowd was where the real appreciation could be found. When hundreds or sometimes thousands of adoring people crowded into temporary wooden bleachers to watch his plays, the plays he wrote, it was hard not to love them. Even when their disapproval rained down in hisses and whatever bit of rottenness lay at hand in a city full of filth, Publius still couldn't help but respect them. After all, he was one of them. Rome was home for Publius Terentius Afer. He barely remembered Africa, the land of his birth, from which he'd been taken as a child. Most of his life had been spent here, first as a slave and now as a freedman. His lip curled for a moment as he remembered the years of adolescence spent in servitude, the leering gazes of rich senators, the pawing hands on his dark skin, the constant demands to recite Greek poetry and drama from memory, the nights he'd lain awake, sobbing, missing his home and his mother, and dreading what the next day might bring. Publius's real name, the name he'd been born with, was lost to memory. Publius was all he answered to now. He saw now the opportunities that he'd seized in those days, the relationships that had made him well-known and financially comfortable and, above all, free. That didn't mean Publius was happy about what he'd experienced. Without those years of enslavement, however, he wouldn't have the crowd or the adulation or his upcoming trip to Greece. He would walk where his idol, the playwright Menander, had once walked. He would seek out copies of plays he'd only heard about, see performances from the greatest actors of the age, and then return home triumphant with new dramas the crowd and his patrons would celebrate for generations to come. With those thoughts in mind, Publius Terentius Afer turned his attention to the gathering crowd. By the increasing roar, it would be a good show, enough to put away some money for his young daughter's future dowry, and perhaps put a statue in his garden. Those days in the senator's house were long past. Now, Publius could look toward the future. I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. The oldest literature in the Latin language isn't actually that old. By the time anyone in Rome started to write poetry, drama, and history in the city's preferred tongue, the Roman Republic had already conquered Italy, defeated Carthage once, and begun its centuries-long period of dominance over the Mediterranean and beyond. In the decades and centuries to come, Roman armies and Latin literature would reach the Sahara, the Euphrates, the Rhine, and northern Britain. When we look back at the very beginnings of that literary tradition to see who were the writers turning Latin into a language appropriate for those uses, we don't find wealthy, powerful senators. We find individuals from the margins of polite Roman society, recent arrivals from across the Mediterranean. These people were often enslaved or freedmen who were deeply familiar with the seedier side of life in the ancient world. That was the social reality that gave birth to Latin literature. In today's episode, we'll focus on one of the central figures of that literary milieu. Publius Terentius Afer, more commonly known in English as Terence, was one of the first great playwrights in the Latin tradition. For centuries, his plays were required reading for schoolchildren across the Roman Empire, indelibly shaping the Latin language and the literary canon. The scions of the most elite aristocratic families of an empire that spanned a quarter of the globe learned the rules of writing proper Latin from a man who was not only not a native speaker of the language, but who had been enslaved throughout the earliest years of his life. We have only scattered details of Terence's biography, and scholars have spent centuries arguing whether or not those details are accurate. Surely one of the founding fathers of Latin literature couldn't have been a slave, much less a slave from Africa, as Afer, the last part of his name, tells us. The sheer number of attempts to argue around or against the obvious implications of the biography we have dwarfs efforts to understand him in those terms, as a former slave of African descent who nevertheless became Rome's preeminent playwright. To be honest, that says a great deal more about the biases of 19th and 20th century scholars than it does about the social reality of mid-Republican Rome. Luckily, thanks to the efforts of a new generation of historians and classicists, we can now say a great deal more about Terence and the world he experienced. Former slaves and people who hadn't been born Roman weren't just part of that milieu, the all-important context that created a tradition of literature that would last 2,000 years. They built that milieu from the ground up. We'll return to Terence in a little while, but first we need to understand a few essential facts. What Rome was like during Terence's life, which spanned from the 190s to the 160s BC, how the city was transformed by migration from all over the Mediterranean, and how the Latin language fit into a time of truly epical change. Once we've done that, Terence's life story, his real life story, not the version that flattered past generations of scholars, snaps into sharp focus. Let's start with Rome itself. When Terence came to Rome, probably sometime in the 190s or 180s BC, the city was well on its way to becoming the dominant force in the Mediterranean world, the center of an empire rather than a city-state. Rome hadn't always been this powerful. In 380 BC, it was unraveling in the wake of its infamous sack at the hands of the Gauls a few years earlier. Conflicts between the patricians, the blue-blooded Roman aristocracy who controlled the political system, and the plebeians who made up the vast majority of the populace threatened to shred the city's social fabric. Rome was vulnerable. The Gauls could return at any time to finish the job they'd started, and they were just one of the many enemy groups Rome faced. Their nearby Latin cousins were sometimes allies, but just as often enemies. The Italic-speaking mountain folk of central Italy were developing the exact same kind of expansionist political systems as the Romans, often more effectively. And the Etruscans to the north were organized into entrenched urban states, wealthy, sophisticated, and perfectly capable of fighting and beating the Romans. The Greek cities of southern Italy and Sicily then belonged to an entirely different world. 200 years later, on the eve of Terence's arrival, Rome was unrecognizable, as was the imperial republic it controlled. The causes of Rome's rise to global dominance were many, varied, and remain contentious now, but the fact of it was as obvious to people living in the early 2nd century BC as it is to us today. By the time a very young Terence arrived in Italy from Africa, Rome was peerless. Carthage was not yet destroyed, that would happen a few decades down the road in 146 BC, but its defeat in the Second Punic War, shortly before Terence's birth, according to our sources, had left Rome's once great rival a second-rate power. The vast, wealthy Hellenistic kingdoms of the East, the product of Alexander the Great's decade-long rampage through Asia, had fallen to Rome's conquering armies with comical ease. The heirs of Alexander, warrior kings with decades of victories to their exalted names, went out with barely a whimper. Their armies of professional pikemen, heavy cavalry, and war elephants crumbled before legions of Roman farmers, led by aristocratic, part-time soldiers vying for the respect and votes of the Republic's electorate. Huge quantities of plunder, silver, precious works of art, and above all, enslaved people flowed into Italy from Africa, Greece, Iberia, the Balkans, and Western Asia. Rome was ascendant, and its ascendancy was reshaping the Mediterranean around it. Rome had always been big for a central Italian city-state. That was true in 500 BC, just after the expulsion of Tarquinius Superbus and the foundation of the Republic. It was the case when the Gauls burned part of Rome and held the rest to ransom. It was true on the eve of Hannibal's devastating invasion of Italy. And it was growing even more obvious to Terence's eyes as he observed his adopted home in the first decades of the 2nd century BC. We talked about classical Athens in our episodes on Sosius and Neaira, and by Greek standards, it was a truly enormous polis, or city-state. At the height of the Athenian Empire, some 300,000 people lived scattered across the region of Attica, with tens of thousands dwelling in Athens itself. In Terence's time, Rome probably matched Attica's total population at its peak in the city alone. According to the census figures that have survived the millennia, recorded most thoroughly around 225 BC, Rome had several hundred thousand adult male citizens scattered across Italy, with at least another 500,000 bound to Rome through lesser forms of citizenship or formal allied status. More than anything else, the root cause of Roman dominance was the sheer number of men. Romans and allies alike, willing to fight for it. But why were there so many people bound to Rome? Well, there were a few reasons. First and foremost, the Roman Republic operated on a different model from the Hellenistic empires of the East. When they defeated an enemy, the Romans offered their former foes a chance to be on the winning side in the future. If they allied with Rome, becoming socii in the Roman parlance, they wouldn't have to pay tribute, give up their laws or practices, or turn over control of their communities to Roman magistrates. All the Romans asked was that their allies provide soldiers when Rome called. Because war was a completely normal part of civic life in Italy, these communities would have been fighting anyway. Now, they were just fighting on behalf of Rome. Second, the overall population of Italy, including the city of Rome, was rising dramatically during this time. Birth rates were high, while mortality rates were relatively low, which is a sure sign of the growing prosperity throughout the Italian peninsula. Last, and most importantly, the Roman citizenship model was dramatically different from any other ancient Mediterranean state. We talked about how jealously the Athenians guarded citizenship as a privilege, with only a tiny portion of the population of Attica being eligible and very few routes to achieving it, even for the extraordinary. Rome, by contrast, regularly extended citizenship to whole communities in return for some act of service. Important aristocratic families living in an area of vital strategic importance might receive Roman citizenship to bind them to the Roman state, or as a favor from their powerful allies within the Senate. But the most common way to become a Roman citizen, the path the vast majority of these new Romans followed, was to be freed from slavery. Upon their manumission, the formerly enslaved integrated into the larger Roman community. Not immediately, not without some stigma associated with their old status, but their children and grandchildren would effectively be indistinguishable from those whose ancestors had lived in central Italy for centuries. By Terence's time, even members of the elite senatorial class could count freedmen among their ancestors. They didn't trumpet that fact. Rome's blue bloods always boasted about their elevated ancestry, but it is a demographic and social reality of Rome during this Middle Republic. Personally, I think this is one of the aspects of Roman life that makes the city and its culture so fascinating. On some level, Rome was a place for outsiders and outcasts. Its legendary founder, Romulus, murdered his brother Remus, assembled a band of cattle rustlers and thieves, and abducted women from the neighboring Sabines to be their wives. These were stories that the Romans themselves disseminated and told. Some of the great patrician families of the Republic were proud of their roots elsewhere, and they told and retold the story of their migration to the city for decades or centuries afterwards. The boundaries of Rome and Romanness were always porous from beginning to peak empire. Far more than any other ancient conquerors, the Romans pulled people, not territory, people, into their social and cultural center of gravity. That is the only context in which a life like Terence's can begin to make sense. While Rome was unquestionably the military and political center of the Mediterranean world by Terence's time, it was a cultural backwater. There was no native literary tradition in the Latin language, no instantly recognizable Roman art, and little of the stunning monumental architecture that would, in time, come to define Rome visually. This status, or lack thereof, was a reflection of deeply held Roman cultural mores, especially among the aristocrats who competed for elected office and debated policy in the Senate. They were politicians and soldiers, the heads of the most elite clans, gentes in the Roman parlance, whose responsibilities were leading men in battle, winning elections, and advancing their family fortunes. As the decades passed and the empire grew, they became businessmen as well. The lion's share of the spoils from Rome's conquests went to these men, and those spoils became crews of enslaved workers who could be rented out for profit, workshops producing pottery or bakeries churning out hundreds of loaves of bread, merchant shipping ventures, and hundreds of tightly managed commercial farms in the countryside around the city. Roman aristocrats were socialized into a highly competitive world where there was always another elected office to seek, another new region to conquer, and another enemy to defeat, be it a rival within the Senate or an Iberian chieftain. Appreciating art and literature didn't really factor into the daily calculus of their lives. Rome's increasingly intense interactions with the Greek world changed all that. As Roman armies began to spend more time in southern Italy and Sicily, they encountered Greek literature, art, and civic life. It's not a coincidence that the earliest literary works in Latin that we know of appeared at precisely the same time Roman generals were rampaging through Greek-speaking cultural outposts like Tarentum and Agrigentum in Sicily. In fact, the earliest figure we know of who wrote literature in Latin was a Greek man who had been enslaved and brought to Rome. Livius Andronicus, probably taken during the sack of Tarentum in 272 BC, started off simply translating texts like Homer's Odyssey into Latin for his aristocratic pupils, eventually branching out into tragedy and comedy. In his historical context, Livius Andronicus was an enslaved schoolmaster first, and only secondarily, a founder of the Latin literary tradition. That kind of marginal status is nearly universal among the earliest exponents of Latin poetry and drama. Not all were enslaved, but several were, and even those who weren't slaves or freedmen came from small towns, spoke Greek or a non-Latin Italic language natively, and made their living from manual labor or rank-and-file military service. No aristocrat was going to sully himself and his family's reputation by writing poetry or composing a play for the stage. But by Terence's time, half a century after Livius Andronicus lived and worked, it was common for those elite families to keep a highly educated slave around to teach their future senators reading, writing, logic, philosophy, and the other myriad skills Greek elites had been acquiring for centuries. Some of those aristocrats started to appreciate Greek culture on its own merits. The famous general Scipio Africanus, who defeated Hannibal in the Second Punic War, was notorious for his wearing of Greek clothing, his attendance at the gymnasium, and his clean-shaven face, which sparked great suspicion among his contemporaries. This, at last, brings us back to Terence. We have only scattered biographical details about him, most of them from a mostly unreliable author and narrator, Suetonius, who was writing 200 years after Terence's death. According to Suetonius, Terence was born in Carthage around 195 BC and then forcibly brought to Italy, where he was enslaved by the senator, Terentius Lucanus. Terentius Lucanus was smitten by the young man's good looks. He was slender and dark, and his intelligence. It wasn't long before Lucanus freed him. This detail strongly suggests that Terence's early life, certainly his entire adolescence, was spent in a non-consensual sexual relationship with his master, a Roman senator. So long as they were enslaved, pubescent boys were fair game for Roman men. Unlike the Greeks, they never sanctioned relationships between free adolescent boys and adult men, so wealthy Roman men often did exactly the same thing as Terentius Lucanus. They bought enslaved boys like Terence to function as child servants to their adult desires. During his time with the senator, Terence made the acquaintance of other elite Romans, including Scipio Africanus, who brought Carthage to its knees in the Second Punic War. Scipio, too, was said to have favored Terence's good looks. But Terentius Lucanus had a preferred sexual demographic. Once the young Terence aged out of it, he was freed, and it was then that his life as a dramatist began. Unfortunately, none of the six plays that survive either contradict or add anything to this skeletal outline of Terence's biography. But there's no a priori reason to doubt the accuracy of these details. In fact, they align neatly with the backgrounds of other early Latin literary figures, if not the expectations of modern scholars, and none of it clashes with our understanding of Rome at that time. If anything, I would guess that Terence might have been a little older than his given 195 BC birthdate suggests, that he was taken as a captive in the Second Punic War. That seems likely to me. We know that there was an active slave trade across the Mediterranean at this time. With favorable winds, a ship that left Carthage on a Monday could be in Rome by Saturday. Elite Roman men sexually attracted to boys openly engaged in this system. If Terence was brought up in a senator's household, as the sources claim, there's every reason to believe that he had access to the kind of education that made him able to read and write fluently in both Greek and Latin. Once freed, he would have been the client of one of Rome's more powerful men, with access to a social circle that was both cultured and well-positioned to commission a dramatist. Giving back to the people, the populus Romanus, was part of a Roman aristocrat's duty, the inviolable social contract that bound every tier of Roman society together. Any up-and-coming senator would be a fool to forego the chance to fund a public feast or put on a play at one of the major religious festivals. By Terence's time, plays were expected. As the money from Rome's many Mediterranean conquests rolled in, the Roman public's taste in entertainment grew more sophisticated, with drama taking on increased value. That's the context that gives us these earliest examples of Latin drama, including Terence's works and those of his contemporaries. It was natural for a senator to commission someone he knew, someone whose knowledge of Greek literature had been put on display at parties since he was an adolescent. Enter Terence, whose plays are all adaptations of Greek originals that had been performed for centuries. Several of these productions were smash hits. The surviving manuscripts of Terence's works include notices about production dates and even gate revenue, and they tell us that audiences responded positively, with a couple of exceptions. Nobody's perfect. Terence, however, was not satisfied with these six plays. Whether he felt he had more to learn or he was tired of Rome, our sources say both, Terence decided to travel to Greece to learn more about Greek drama from its source. He left Rome around 160 BC, shortly after his last play was performed. In the East, he found the complete works of the Greek dramatist Menander and adapted dozens of his plays into Latin for future showings in Rome. But Terence never returned. His baggage, containing those dozens of adapted plays, may have been lost in transit, sending Terence into a depressive spiral that killed him. He may have been shipwrecked along with his works. We just don't know. Either way, Terence was never seen in Rome again, and his six plays are all we have left of him. According to some sources, Terence died broke and friendless, abandoned by his aristocratic supporters. That's hard to square with the report that he had 20 acres of gardens on the Appian Way and his daughter married a member of the Equestrian Order, the extraordinarily wealthy group just below the senators in Rome's hierarchy. Of those two options, the second seems much more likely. We know Terence was well-connected, that his plays were positively received, and that he had the resources to spend a year in Greece learning about drama and adapting plays. The amount of money necessary to have 20 acres on the Appian Way, spend a year in Greece, and fund a dowry for marriage into the Equestrian Order was pocket change to the ultra-wealthy patrons we know Terence had. I'm inclined to agree with the assessment of Terence scholars Anthony Augustakis and Ariana Trail, that those patrons saw Terence as a living symbol of Romanization, a boy from Africa until recently Rome's enemy, raised in the household of a Roman senator, and trained to become the greatest living exponent of the Latin language. This wasn't a civilizing process exactly, the Carthaginians weren't barbarians, but something rather different. Terence was proof that the Roman way of life, this intense, ongoing, and mostly involuntary process of cultural integration, actually worked. That would certainly help to explain why later Romans were so fond of him and why those details about his early life stayed in those sources. He validated the Romans' core beliefs about Rome's unique ability to turn foreigners, including the formerly enslaved, into productive and respectable Romans. After his death, Terence's works became standard reading for Roman schoolchildren. Some of the best-known authors in the corpus of Latin literature remembered him fondly. Cicero addresses him directly in one of his many references to the playwright, quote, "You, Terence, who alone reclothe Menander in choice speech and render him in the Latin tongue, you present him with your quiet utterance on our public stage, speaking with a certain graciousness and with sweetness in every word." A cunning eye reading through Cicero's many, many works finds constant quotations, echoes, and inspirations derived directly from Terence. Caesar was even more fulsome. He was quoted by Suetonius as saying, quote, "You too are ranked among the highest, you half Menander, and justly, you lover of language undefiled." But we cannot forget the world that Terence inhabited, or the facts of his life as he lived it. Yes, there were senators and fine parties and amounts of money that most people in Republican Rome could never have imagined. But Terence was also a dark-skinned outsider, not unique, but certainly unusual, in a city fueled by the slave trade that had stolen him from his home in Africa. Literally and figuratively, Terence was only steps away from the seedy taverns where actors and stagehands drank and ate, and the humble houses and slums where the masses of poor Romans who attended his plays lived. Had his life gone even slightly differently, Terence would have been among them rather than writing works to be performed on the stage. Terence made the best of the life available to him, as so many enslaved people have been forced to do over the millennia. Like Caesar and Cicero, we can and should celebrate him for his literary accomplishments. But we should also appreciate the difficulties of the circumstances Terence survived and eventually escaped. In that, as much as his facility with Latin, Terence was unusual. Next time on Past Lives, we'll stay in Rome, but move a few decades ahead to one of the most famous events in antiquity, the rebellion of the enslaved gladiator Spartacus. One of Spartacus's lieutenants was a Gaul named Crixus, and through Crixus, we'll come to understand what resistance to slavery could look like in its most indelible form. Thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The sound design and music is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.